changes to the public health system bill, addressing a loophole in high school graduation requirements, plus proposed property tax reform, and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending April 7th, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, local health departments will have a longer list of core services they must provide to get increased funding after changes to legislation made by a House committee. The legislation's list of about two dozen core public health services previously included food and sanitary inspections, access to immunizations, tobacco cessation, and maternal and child health care, among others. House Public Health Committee Chair Brad Barrett's amendment to the bill added the prevention and reduction of chronic illnesses, including obesity, diabetes, cancer, and behavioral and mental health.
Bottom line of this policy is that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
The amendment also says that local health departments can spend no more than 40% of their funding on food, sanitary, water and septic system inspections, pest control, and behavioral and mental health care services. Is the bill too prescriptive on local health departments? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney. Republican Jennifer Hollowell. John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, something we've heard throughout the session about this bill is this, you know, we don't want a state takeover of local public health departments. And of course, repeatedly, it has been said this is not that. But how much those departments can spend on which priorities, controlling that, is that go a little too far?
I don't know. I mean, I think what's important about this bill, frankly, is the emphasis on prevention, the idea that we're actually going to go out there and deal with some of the very, very serious health problems citizens of Indiana have. I think it's a good thing. Now, is 40% the magic number? I think what they're trying to do is to make sure that the expansion of services is funded with this additional money. And if it's too much or too little to do their core services that they've always been doing, you know, the legislature meets every year. They can adjust it. But the important part is that we're actually facing up to the fact that we have significant health problems in this state, and we're going to try to do something to help alleviate that problem.
Yeah, Senator Ed Charbonneau, who's the author of this bill, you know, on the Senate floor when it was being passed earlier this session, talked about the sea change that we're trying to do, moving away from just reacting and treating illness to preventing it in the first place. And this amendment from Dr. Barrett gets even more direct to that point. So is at least that part of the bill, I mean, this is now a really long list of core services. Mm-hmm. Are local health departments going to be able to handle that?
Well, I think so, and I think, first, the whole impetus of this is, as Ann was saying, you know, we have some pretty bad health outcomes in Indiana, and they're, you know, chronic illnesses, things that are, you know, preventable, smoking, obesity, et cetera, and so I think that this is, a great way, frankly, to put the emphasis there and make sure that we are focused on the kinds of numbers that we're trying to move, not numbers, these are people, their lives, but the outcomes that we're looking for, not just beefing up all of the services that they may typically already provide and fund. And so, you know, and Chairman Barrett is a physician, and, so I think he's done a great job with this bill, and I think at the end of this session, what we are doing for public health is going to be one of the big highlights.
I'm not going to play the amount of work that's gone into moving this bill so far, from lawmakers to former State Senator Luke Kenley and Dr. Chris Box, the State Health Commissioner, who've done a lot of work behind the scenes to allay a lot of fears about this bill. But, again, one of the fears of this bill was this is the state taking, you know, controlling what local public health departments are doing. Should we be mandating you can only spend this much amount on this and this much amount on that? Doesn't that get to the very fear that they were trying to allay?
Well, some will say that, and certainly will look at it and say this, aha, we knew that this was the real motive, that the state, this mysterious big brother, was trying to control our decision-making at the local level. But clearly, that's not what's at work here. And you're right, the behind-the-scenes efforts have been significant. And not only since January when the session began, but to your point, back well over a year, because some of the people you mentioned, Chris Box, Luke Kinley, were part of a task force, a commission, that spent a lot of time and gathered a lot of information and looked at a lot of best practices to offer suggestions. Keep in mind that the suggestions they offered in terms of financial, the sort of allocation that would be necessary to bring Indiana up to speed, are still not going to be achieved by, in all likelihood, by the budget that's enacted. I mean, the governor already had scaled it back once, and then we saw the House budget scale it back again. So, yeah, it plays to those fears, but my goodness, I mean, there's a dire need for it. It's been documented time and time again, and one would think that locals would want to take advantage of this with whatever strings are attached, as long as the dollars are behind it.
I want to ask you, Nikki, about the things that they are restricting the spending on in this now. But this does get to something we've heard earlier this session. I think Senator Travis Holdman has been one of the most outspoken folks, at least on that side of the building, about, you know, if we're trying to improve public health in Indiana, I'm not sure expecting the local public pool is the way you do it. But restaurant inspections, food inspections, pools, sanitary inspections of all sorts of establishments, that's important too, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I personally want to know that the restaurants I'm going to are okay, and God forbid, you know, we've seen, you know, E. coli breakouts and things like that. So those are still important things to do. I think maybe one very cautionary note beyond the fact that we're still waiting to see how much money they're going to put behind the effort is, I mean, part of the reason behind the Public Health Commission was to show that Indiana is woefully underfunding public health and their core services. So I do think there's a little bit of a cautionary note here to be like, we were supposed to be increasing the funding for the existing responsibilities. I'm a little concerned that now we're increasing the funding but giving additional, you know, responsibilities.
So many more additional responsibilities.
So, I mean, I do think we need to make sure on that. If we're just giving them more money to do new things, that's not going to help us improve our overall.
I imagine we'll talk about this again on the show because I'm not going to spend more time to do it now. But one of the things we have to talk about is, I think, you know, this funding will be for 2 years. And the thought here is not every county is going to agree to take this money right away. The hope is that some counties will, and then the counties who don't will look at the counties who do and go, oh, yeah, I'd like our county to be able to have access to all of that. But the problem is, with these metrics, because it does have to be metric-driven. If we're spending money on things that aren't working, we shouldn't be spending that money. But these things move slowly. We're not going to instantly make all of Indiana healthier. And so the push and pull of, we need to keep spending this money, even if we can't see immediate results, is going to be fascinating down the road.
And most people don't even know what public health is. So my suggestion, only somewhat flippant suggestion, would be if you, instead of saying public in the phrase public health, call it preventive health or call it something else, because that semantic change, I think, will ease the concern that some people have that if word public is attached to it, it's somehow bad. I don't need to go any further. That's all I need to know.
All right, a bill that would have made it harder for Indiana students to use a military exam to graduate from high school was substantially weakened by lawmakers this week. From WFII's education desk, Dylan Piers McCoy reports on the new plan to narrow a loophole in state diploma rules.
Nearly 20% of high school graduates relied on a military test to meet state requirements in 2021. Some policymakers say that's a problem because many of those students didn't enlist. The latest plan to address those concerns requires any student who uses a score on the military test to graduate to submit a form that affirms their intent to enlist. Republican Jeff Rotz is the chair of the Senate Education and Career Development Committee.
This simply just charges the State Board to take a look at it and come back and make sure that what recommendations we can make to make sure that it's not being utilized inappropriately across the state.
The bill now moves on to the full Senate for approval.
Jennifer Hollowell, does the state need to clamp down more on these military tests?
Well, I think the goal here first is to collect the data so that we know what school districts are using pathways and to what extent to make sure that it's kind of right-sized for what we want to see. I mean, the ultimate number one most important thing, right, is that we are preparing students for the workforce, today's economy, et cetera. And there are various pathways that you can take to that. But first, I think we need to collect the data to see how it's being used by all the various school districts, and then and who's using it, and then get to the intent of, is this the right approach? And I mean, certainly, I'm sure that there are students who take it and then for whatever reason then decide not to enlist. So I don't know that you can require the after the fact, right, proof of that. But it is a big number, and I think we need to see if this is the appropriate use.
Is that part of the trick here? So originally the bill said you have to enlist in order to take this exam, and now the bill says, well, sign a piece of paper that says, I promise I'll enlist, and then you can take the exam, which feels to me a little difficult to enforce. But isn't that the point? Is this a little... We should be able to use this test because there are some folks for whom that is the right way to go. But is keeping it around make it hard to make sure it's only being used for the folks who need to use it?
It is a test that's readily available and inexpensive, much more readily available than other options. If the test doesn't properly judge whether a person should be qualified with a high school diploma, that's a question, okay? But if it does qualify them, why not use it? I mean, only 25% of the graduates of high schools in Indiana would qualify for admission to the military between obesity, drugs, criminal, all kinds of reasons. So, you know, if they're using it and the test does adequately judge whether they're properly qualified as a high school graduate and it's readily available and it's inexpensive, what's the harm?
I mean, I think the concern is that it's an easier test than some
well,
of the other.
Well, that's the question then.
Yeah.
Than some of the other tests. And so it's easier, I mean, I guess if it's easier, then a lot of people are just using it to, you know, get through and get, instead of taking, what, the ACT, the SAT, that those kinds of things that are more, I guess, college-driven
right.
than, say, the ASVAB. So, you know, I think you're right. I would hope they already have some of that data. Frankly, I mean, we know that 20% of them are using it now.
I don't think 20% of our kids are going into the military.
No. Yeah. So, I mean, I definitely think it's a worthwhile discussion to be having.
And this is part of this bill is part of a larger discussion about all of the pathways to graduating from high school. And is this a long overdue conversation? I mean, I know this stuff changes like every 5 minutes in Indiana when it comes to education, but is this particular conversation a little long overdue?
Well, it probably is. You know, education is one of those things, sort of like interstate maintenance. It's never done. I mean, it's just, we will never have a session where lawmakers say, wow, you know, education is great. Well, let's just sit back and watch. If anything, in fact, we probably have had the opposite. We've had a situation that borders maybe on reform fatigue where there's been so much change, and as the emphasis is focused from accountability to compensation to, you know, funding at the school level to self-sufficiency, that really, to Jennifer's point, I don't know if we've ever had the data catch up with the moves. So a lot of this has been well-intended and sincere attempts to get at the issue, but unless we probably take a breath and let things catch up, I'm not sure if we can ever assess fully.
But then that creates the fear of falling behind.
Well, you don't want to have... Well, yeah. That's already happened.
We're already falling
yeah,
behind.
Well, certainly with COVID.
The question just is, I really think you have to get back to the fundamental question is whether the test judges whether someone's qualified to be a high school graduate. I don't think the SAT or the ACT are the right mechanism for someone not going to college. And they're much more expensive than taking this test.
Yeah.
So if we don't think that's good enough, then we should develop our own, make it readily available and inexpensive.
Of course, some colleges are dispensing with
standardized
test requirements.
For the same reason.
Yeah. All right, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we post an unscientific online poll question. And this week's question is, should students who aren't going to enlist in the military be allowed to use a military exam to graduate from high school? A yes or B no. Last week's question was, will the indictment of former President Donald Trump help his re-election bid? 25% of you say yes, 75% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Hoosiers will be getting their property tax bills in the coming days and weeks if you haven't already received yours, and many of those bills are going to be a lot higher than last year's. And that's why one state lawmaker with a familiar last name says the property tax system needs major reform. increased home prices across much of Indiana are driving up home values, and that in turn is raising many Hoosiers' property tax bills. There's nothing state lawmakers can do to decrease the cost of the bills people are getting this year, but Democratic Representative Ed Delaney says the spike in bills highlights ongoing issues with the property tax system.
One of the core problems with the property tax system is this up and down, and also the fact that it's simply too complicated.
Delaney says the state needs to increase its funding for public schools, which he says are too reliant on property taxes.
If we do that, it reduces the pressure on the property taxes as a support for the schools and frees up property tax revenue for things that are truly local.
Delaney says that includes local government and public safety.
Nikki Kelly, there's going to be pressure on lawmakers right now and in the coming days and weeks as people get these bills to address how high those bills are. But that ship has sailed. So does the pressure for larger reform kind of die down after the initial shock of this year's bills?
Yeah, I mean, they obviously can't affect this year's bills. There is a bill being heard next week that's a property tax reform, not reform, just a property tax vehicle. They could maybe help out for a few years. But the point... I'm not a good person for this because I'm not a person who hates property taxes. I feel like they have a role and a place. I also feel like they're operating the way they should, which is cyclical. The economy moves, and so your property taxes go up, and then they go down, and they go up, and they go down. Guess what? We're in the point where everyone saw their values of their homes go up, and that's now going to be reflected in your bill. You know, so I think, if anything, they should focus more on the assessment side of it and making sure we're getting that right. But I don't think I'm their target audience on this one.
John, let me ask you this, which is, that was a question raised to Representative Delaney, who I think is related in some way to somebody who sits on
blood.
Not by blood. No, that would be troubling. it was a question raised to him, which was, isn't this just kind of the way it happens? We've had several years of rising home prices, and so your property taxes are generally going to go up. Not necessarily by the same amount, by the way, because the levy might change. Marion County's levy went down a little
My
bit,
levy went down
even
too.
Though property tax bills did go up, but not as high, clearly, as they could have. So isn't this just the way it's supposed to
work?
I
mean, to a certain extent, that is what happens, just like sales tax during inflationary times when prices were going up. Guess what? The cash register was ringing, and the state coffers were bulging because of additional revenue. So, yes, it is the way these mechanisms are set up. They're largely dependent on market forces. Let's face it. People don't like taxes. I mean, if any tax goes up 21%, as the suggestion is here, at one time, people are going to balk. But if they do look at the big picture, which is asking a lot, because most people don't want to look at the big picture, and understandably, they're trying to get through the next day financially in many cases. But Indiana is still a much more affordable state in terms of property taxes than I won't say anywhere in the country, than a lot of states. New York, anything on the East Coast, at least north of the Mason-Dixon line, West Coast, they would kill to have...
Just next door in Illinois.
They would kill to have the kinds of property tax caps that are in place here now. Tax revenue, if you want to have government, if you want to have government services, it's got to come from somewhere, to Nikki's point. And we have yet to figure out that entity, that constituency to tax that A, is flush with cash and doesn't object. So once we find them, we'll be fine.
Maybe it's Nikki.
flush with cash.
Is there some point, though, to trying to rein in? I mean, these things are always going to be a little cyclical. Is there an argument to be made that we need to control maybe the level of volatility that you see? I mean, this is this year being a bit of an outlier, but it's a huge jump for a lot of folks. Does something need to be done to try and rein in that volatility a little bit?
Well, that's certainly the argument that folks are making, especially for what's tied to those property tax dollars, the local budgets that are, you know, relying on them, and the fluctuation can be a challenge, especially when you're planning, you know, budgets years ahead and contracts, et cetera. But, you know, Nikki mentioned on Tuesday, Ways and Means Chairman Thompson's bills being heard by Senate Tax and Fiscal Committee, and that would reduce slightly, but would have an impact for the next 2 years, the 1%. So you have that happening, and then I think this is really all part of a much bigger conversation, which Senate Bill 3 looks at, you know, a two-year kind of commission for an overhaul, like, review of the tax structure, which could impact income taxes, property taxes, et cetera. And I think that's, you know, we're looking at a longer-term approach with
that. The big picture that John was
talking about.
From a political standpoint, because politics does matter here, if you're a state lawmaker, you have a feeling, well, people are just going to be a little upset because they assume that we control everything, and to a certain extent on property taxes, they somewhat do. Do you just kind of ride out the storm and try and take that more measured, long-term look at, do we need to change the system a little bit again?
Well, I think we need a longer look and how they interact, because when we were told that the state was going to pick up the cost of public education, it's now about 42% of the cost of public education. So there are things that need to be adjusted and looked at. The problem is, I think particularly with property tax, it's a very volatile political issue. Talk to Part Peterson about what happened in 2008 with that. And it also affects people on fixed incomes dramatically. You know, you have people, and I understand they're sitting on an asset, and maybe they ought to think about selling, but they've lived in it all their adult lives. They don't want to move. And all of a sudden, they have a bill they didn't count on a fixed income. It makes a difference. So the structure needs to be looked at all over, and we need to be able to take more of the cost of education off local government. Anybody who's driven the streets, they are in terrible condition because there isn't money to fix them. And, you know, I look at this and I remember a skit from Colbert on TV for coming from the Washington National Airport, but it looked like a third world country. There are streets in my neighborhood that look like they're in a third world country. And we need the resources to fix those. I mean, it's crazy that we don't think these things through and allocate the resources when we have so much money on hand statewide.
Well, you raised Bart Peterson, though, and last year, Marion County, looking ahead and saying, oh, yeah, these things are going to go up. We know they're going to go up. Passed a little bit of property tax relief that everybody is seeing on their bills. It helped my mom, who's on a fixed income, out quite a lot.
It's going to help a number of people out.
So,
a lot.
But not every local community had the resources to be
able
to do that.
That's right.
Well, let's be fair. Those resources were federal government.
Yes, they were. That's what I'm saying. Indianapolis had a lot of federal money that came
from COVID. But they had the sense to do it before it bubbled up from below like it did in 2008.
Yeah, they were lucky that they were able to use those funds in that way.
Right.
The ACLU of Indiana has filed a lawsuit in an attempt to halt Indiana's gender-affirming care ban for transgender youth before it takes effect July 1st. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman reports their legal arguments rest on constitutional violations and equal protections for transgender Americans.
Ken Falk is the ACLU of Indiana's legal director. He says Indiana's gender-affirming care ban violates the 14th Amendment because it discriminates on the basis of sex, it discriminates against transgender residents, and violates the Equal Protections Clause.
The legislature did not ban the various treatments that are outlined. It only banned it for transgender persons.
The U.S. Supreme Court upheld employment protections for transgender people in a 2020 decision. The ACLU is representing care providers, transgender youth, and their parents in a class action lawsuit.
This is a dangerous law. This is a cruel law. This is a law that we hope to enjoin.
The lawsuit itself was filed in federal court on April 5th.
John Schwanes, with the current U.S. Supreme Court, is this lawsuit nothing more than a hope and a prayer in the long term?
Well, you would like to say that the court, regardless of any political persuasion or affiliation, would look at these issues. And the Equal Protection Clause argument does seem to have merit. I'm no attorney, but, I mean, it does seem to... I mean, there are ways they could have gotten around it, frankly, with different approach to the statute that might have addressed or eased or eliminated those concerns. So I guess that's a long-winded way of saying let's hope that the courts can look at these things in an isolated case-by-case manner, factoring everything in rather than just being swept up in some tidal wave of pro-life zeal or pro-choice zeal.
Nikki Kelly, to the best of my knowledge, George Washington and James Madison didn't use the word transgender at any point. So
they didn't use abortion either.
No, but so exactly, which is why that protection no longer exists, according to the U.S. Supreme Court. So to that end, is this just nothing more than a hope and a prayer for transgender youth in Indiana?
I'm a little Pollyanna. I'm going to say no. I mean, I do think the equal protection argument is going to be a hard one to get around because they're treating who gets it differently than the actual treatment itself.
All right. Well, finally, the Senate this week sent a bill to the governor that would fully legalize throwing stars in Indiana, rescinding a ban that's been in place since the 1980s. Now, Ann Delaney, is it true that only a good guy with a throwing star can stop a bad guy with a throwing star?
Oh, my God. I think a good guy with a throwing star loses to a bad guy with a gun.
Well, that's probably true.
You haven't watched enough James Bond movies.
Are you a little surprised? This was originally supposed to be just for, like, these axe-throwing venues that, they could also offer throwing stars. Are you a little surprised that the legislature just said, nah, everybody can just have them again?
That's just issue.
I think the House said to the Senate, like, we'll see you one and raise you one, right?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. I was a little surprised at that. And also how quickly this went. Like, no real pushback.
Are you carrying?
I'm not carrying yet. That's July 1st.
Do we
July
have 1st. Pent-up demand?
Yeah, July 1st.
Do we need a license for the throwing
No,
stars?
We definitely
no,
don't
you
need
can
a
have
threat.
It. You can have
That's
it.
Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at wfyi.org/IWIR or on the PBS video app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.